Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here talking about home improvement on the show today. And we'll kick off by talking a bit about electricity to start. Then we'll look at trends in lighting design, electrical upgrades you can make in your home, and some common issues with wiring. With our two guests, Chad Spaidback with us. Chad's owner of Chad's Design Build. And Chad, good to see your smiling face.
Thanks, Larry. It's always great to be here.
And with us back after a few years, Travis Larson, president and co-owner of Design Electric in Madison. Travis, good to see you again.
Nice to see you too.
As we talk with our guests, of course, we want to hear from you. Tell us about how you're thinking of changing up your home's lighting, maybe. Are you planning to upgrade to some smart kind of bulbs? What do you need to know? They will have some answers for you. And, of course, if you have other home remodeling repair issues, we can talk about those certainly as well as we move along. The number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Travis, let's start with you. It's been a while, so maybe you could talk about your background and your business and the kinds of projects you work on.
Well, my partner and I decided that we wanted to specialize exclusively on remodeling with an emphasis on lighting design and installation. That's kind of where my passion runs into it. So our business is fairly small. We've got five electricians. We do quite a few projects weekly, typically very small ones. A lot of them will involve some, you know, pretty heavy lighting design, because that's where I think the fun comes into it.
Mm-hmm.
But we do service upgrades, home rewires. There's still a few houses here in the Madison area that are running on, you know, early 1900s wiring, call it knob and tube, and we'll get rid of that for you. A pretty serious trend right now is service upgrades, with kind of the emergence and popularity of the electric vehicle charging, which does take a good chunk of power. We are doing a lot of service upgrades these days. So, but as a whole, it's all almost exclusively remodeling, which is where we like it to be.
Chad, what kinds of wiring capabilities are your customers looking for these days?
Yeah, so certainly improving switching and of course, light design, having good lighting, good task lighting. And with the revolution in LED lighting, with being able to, you know, pretty much determine what warmth of light you want, the actual color quality of the light, you know, that has led people to a variety of options that just didn't exist easily, you know, 10, 20 years ago. So, and then of course, we're always adding outlets places where maybe they should have been installed originally, but that's just part of remodeling.
So. Yeah. And trends from your mind, Travis?
It took a long time for me to be comfortable with LED in terms of the color that Chad's already kind of insinuated. As a guy who grew up with incandescent light, halogen light, I was pretty persnickety in terms of what I liked, what made me feel good, what was comfortable, and I don't think I'm alone in that. It took a long time for LED to actually catch up in quality. They were always really efficient, you know, because they use a very little wattage, but they weren't too comfortable, and I feel within the last year, 2 years, we've finally gotten to a point where it's almost you can't even discern the difference between them unless you put them side by side, because it's really hard to match wattage and lumen output and all that. But when I relamp a house exclusively with LED, you can leave on Monday, come back on Tuesday, and very likely not notice the difference. And that was what really made it easy for me to start selling LED as almost an exclusive source. So I've still got a few clients who aren't super excited about changing over. The perception of LED as only a sterile blue light source is still kind of out there to some. So, you know, it's not universal that everybody's doing it, but it's gotten really easy to sell it now because it's very comfortable.
Yeah. I was thinking about lighting pieces a lot. You know, we did a remodel, a total remodel, went down to the studs and started back. And the lighting, I'm still happy with the pieces. And I was wondering, you know, our chandeliers, what are they? Does anybody put a chandelier in?
Absolutely. Anymore?
Yeah.
Yeah. So the only difference between chandeliers then and chandeliers now is typically the technology in the light bulb. So again, with, you know, LED basically taking over the marketplace, they have gotten to where they have created light bulbs that are so similar in aesthetic to the old school, like a clear light bulb, the filament-based light bulbs. A lot of people call them Edison-based or the Edison bulbs or the vintage bulbs that have got the strings through them that are illuminating. LED is simulating that so well now that it's really hard to tell the difference in that statement piece between incandescent and LED when you're not putting the bulbs side by side. And, you know, the LED integrated fixture, which doesn't even have light bulbs, is certainly starting to find its way into homes, more contemporary than traditional. So one of the neat things about Madison to me is that there are so many beautiful old homes that are trying to be maintained as old homes.
Yeah.
That we see a lot more fixtures that take light bulbs. I prefer that because a light bulb that fails is a lot easier to change than an integrated fixture. Plus, if you've got a dislike towards the color of the light bulb and you don't know it until 3 months after the project's finished, you just change the color of the light bulbs. So I do like that. But yeah, we see a ton of chandeliers.
I'm wondering about the kitchen. I was thinking about my own kitchen because I had a bulb go, and I've got a pretty high ceiling, and it's going to be, I have to get the stepladder out to get it changed. But there's a place where I imagine you have to be able to see details, but you also kind of want maybe a warm and welcoming kind of light.
I think warm and welcoming is something that just about everybody wants in their home. We work in sterility all day.
Yeah.
You know, some of the cooler color temperatures and such are really great for, you know, illuminating a workspace. But once you get home, and I mean, there's science to that too. Once you get into the higher color spectrums, it starts to suppress the production of melatonin. So, I mean, if you get into that 5,000 and 6,000 Kelvin rating, which is that cool white and bluish light, well, that's what daylight is. And we're awake in the daylight for a reason. So, so the comfortable, warmer tones is something that, you know, there's a bit of technology to that as well as it pertains to our brain. But I don't run into a lot of people who prefer to not have that warmer temperature in the home setting. And you know, you can't help but think some of it is because of work. That's what I don't work in warm, so I guess I'm going to live in warm. But yeah, and there are newer technologies right now that are called dim to warm. When we had incandescent light bulbs and you dim it down, it changes color. So you go from that warm white, which is a 2700 Kelvin. That's the number we assign to that 60-watt light bulb. It's 2700 Kelvin. When we dim that down, you get down into 2400 and even 2200 when you get down to where it's about 10% from off, right? So that is something that always, to me, felt like it brought that candlelight vibe to any kind of setting where you really bring that orangey warm glow into that. LED in its earlier stages didn't do that. It just got dim. So instead of being warm and fuzzy, it's just gray. So they have what they call a dim-to-warm system now that's really starting to find its way into popularity, at least on the market. And now there's some really good, and it's stripped down, it's injecting a little bit of red and orange LED into the mix as the white LED dims. So it's...
How do you pick that out if you're going to the store to buy a...
Don't have a ton of it at the store to buy it. When you get into some of the larger retailers on that, Philips is a brand that has a couple of them that are retail available. Most of them are available more online than anything else. You get into the commercial grade stuff when you're doing the integrated LEDs. The recessed lights that we use, as an example, aren't available retail. It's only on a commercial basis, on a wholesale basis. And they're from brands that really aren't super talked about.
Yeah.
It's because they're not a retail brand. But Philips, as one, you know, the maker of the Hue bulb is one of the original color changing. They make a warm dim, warm glow. I can't remember what their trade name is for it, but those are available at places like Home Depot. You can get them on Amazon, that type of thing. But other than that, there's not a lot of them out there. You're going to need to talk to a trade professional for most of them.
You know, I was thinking about this studio. In the morning, the morning show folks, where earlier in the day, their lighting is always at about half. And as the day goes, like you get to me, I turn the first thing I do when I walk into the studio is turn the light up.
Interesting. Yeah.
And it's virtually every day that happens. And I don't know if it's the time of day that's going on with all of us, but
hard
I like it bright.
Right.
I like it bright to start. Chad Spade of Chad's Design Build and Travis Larson, president and co-owner of Design Electric of Madison. Started out by talking lighting. We'll take other issues as well relating to home renovation and repair as we talk with our guests. And you can join in. The number to call 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Zach emailed, he noted that when shopping for new light fixtures, a lot of LED fixtures don't have replaceable bulbs. Do you just throw those fixtures out when the light burns out?
Well, we like to see them recycled, but yes, there are places in Madison, the diodes themselves, there are electronic parts to them that need to be recycled. But yeah, it's a disposable piece. They don't have typically replaceable parts, particularly in the larger retail places because they're so inexpensive. Replacement parts in and of themselves would cost more than the fixture itself because the manufacturers don't sell them. So yeah, if you don't buy a fixture that takes screw-in light bulbs and it fails, you're throwing it away.
No, but you can recycle
yep.
it.
Yep. Yeah, places like Resource Solutions on the north side of Madison takes them. That's where we take a lot of ours. So yeah, but they're all of the components in an LED want to be recycled, less the plastic. There's a plastic cover or something like that. They're not, but all of the integrated, the diode pieces and the drivers on the inside, the electronics, the metal base, those are all recyclable pieces.
So you don't feel quite so bad
yeah.
about it. Travis or Tarsus emailed us. They have an older home. In the bathroom, there's a large mirror with lights over it. And then a medicine cabinet below it. They want to replace all of that with just a mirror and lighting. Would an electrician be able to remove the mirror and cabinet in addition to the lighting, or are separate contractors required?
I suppose it would probably depend on the contractor you're working with. We don't typically get into carpentry work in terms of removals like that. You know, we'd call Chad and tag team it. That would typically two different trade professionals to both take it apart and put it back together.
Chad, on your end, would
yeah, well, so part of the answer to the question will be, you know, what is going in to replace it? Because yeah. there are a lot of beautiful medicine cabinets that have, you know, integrated lighting and, of course, mirrors. And you
sure.
can, you know, open them up and have, like, three-way mirrors and stuff like that. So, you know, the question will be, once that mirror is removed, does the wall need to be repaired? Will the new fixtures cover all of the spaces that would otherwise need to be repaired? You know, that'll be part of the calculus on that.
In terms of the technology, too, you want to make sure that whatever you're putting in, typically they need to be GFI protected. That GFI protection needs to be in a easily accessible location so you can't cram it behind, say, a surface-mounted lighted mirror.
Yeah.
So to Chad's point, the technology motivates a lot of that.
Makes good sense. Steve in Ironwood, Michigan has a question. Hi, Steve.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, appreciate the call.
This is lighting, but car lighting. Years ago, when you saw a deer at night, the eyes just glowed right back at you. Now with halogen headlights, that doesn't happen anymore. I don't know if it's the headlights or what the reason is.
You got me swinging.
Yeah.
The headlights can be a completely different technology. I believe the newer stuff on the cars, I think, is all LED. But why it may or may not reflect an eyesight or eyes on that eye, I have certainly never researched.
Yeah, that
don't know.
I don't know either. So the three of us are
stump the panel, Steve. Stump. Well done.
Somebody's going to call yes. in and have a response to you, Steve. So stay listening. Chad Spade, Travis Larson, our guest today. You can join in too. Number to call 800-642-1234 or email to talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining us today on WPR News as we look at home renovation and repair. A little later on at 12:30, we'll talk about how to repair and prevent mold and water damage in your home. But right now, we're talking home renovation and repair in general. We've zeroed in on electricity a bit and lighting, but certainly take other questions as well as we move along at 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. That's talk at WPR.org. Chad, when you're doing some renovation and repair, I imagine one of the first things you do is look at the electrical system to make sure it's going to be up for handling whatever changes.
Sure. That, you know, all of the systems in the home, really, you know, you've got the electrical panel, and if you're adding on to a home or making some significant alterations that might increase the demand for power, then that's going to be an issue. I mean, Travis alluded to the one big thing that we're seeing a lot of right now, putting in EV chargers in people's homes. You know, depending on the size of that charger, you know, it's going to be a 30, 50, maybe 60 amp like draw on that.
We're seeing even 100 on quite a few of them.
Okay. So. Okay. Yeah. So, you know, that's the entire demand of a typical older 100-amp system. And, you know, many homes now end up with a 200-amp system.
Yeah.
You know, some larger homes that have a few EV chargers, you know, that's probably not going to be enough. So it's just...
Yeah, we're seeing 320-amp services certainly more often. You got to check with the utility company, find out whether it's even available on the grid in the neighborhood. I haven't run into anywhere they're not yet. But yeah, to Chad's point, most houses, I would never recommend more than 100-amp service 15 years ago.
That's what I was going to ask.
Yeah. Thought about as a necessity. And now, exactly. If you upgrade to anything less than 200, it's criminal. Because somebody's going to ask for something coming down there. And extending it, we've got heat pumps are taking the place of standard air conditioners. They can draw quite a bit more power. There is water heaters now that are a heat pump water heater, a condensing water heater. That takes quite a bit of a 240-volt feed to it. It doesn't necessarily use it all the time, but it when it gets to a demand basis, it can draw a lot of power. And code's going to dictate the size of the service entrance, regardless of when those pieces are operating. Some homes may function fine with an EV charger and electric range because they're used at different times of the day, but code doesn't allow for it because we got a demand factor on the panel that we have to work through. So 200 amps is pretty much on any kind of renovation, almost a given from what I've seen.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was thinking code. Sometimes code means the minimum.
Mm-hmm.
Correct.
And most of the time, you want to be better. If you're remodeling, you probably want to be better than code.
Yeah, but to Travis's point, I mean, it's true that, you know, 10, 15 years ago, you know, some of our potential clients would say, you know, don't I need to upgrade to 200 amps? And it's like, well, you know, not necessarily.
Yeah.
And because it all comes down to what you're doing in your home. And whether you're really going to need it.
Home with a gas range, gas dryer, gas furnace, gas water heater is using next to nothing for power. So anything more than 100-amp service on that house just wasn't thought about. And those were the only appliances that could really add to it. So even if we changed, you know, half to two-thirds of those to an electric appliance, we're still fine at 100 amps. Well, now if we change those appliances to 100 and then add the EV charger, 100 isn't enough.
Yeah. Right. So here's the question that may be running through some people's minds. They might be sitting out there saying, how much is it going to cost? How extensive is it to switch from 100 amp to 200 or 300 mm-hmm. amp? Am I going to have to rewire the whole house or you know, what?
Sure.
Rewiring the whole house just to upgrade isn't necessary. We have one individual point typically where we're doing all of that work, and the upgrade in and of itself doesn't send more power to all of the branch wiring and outlets and switches and lights throughout the house. It simply gives us a bigger pot to pull from right down at the panel. So it's not a huge invasion. It's typically done in a day, maybe two. Depends on, you know, the extent we have to go through, the space, possible space limitations.
Yeah.
yeah. the utility company's participation, that type of thing.
Well, that right. should put some people's minds at ease.
Yeah. And, yeah.
Kathleen in Sun Prairie has a comment for us. Hi, Kathleen.
I just want to promote using a professional when you're doing the remodeling. When we remodeled our kitchen, the electrician took out the old microwave and found inside the wall a wire with electrical tape around the end and a post-it note on it saying live wire.
Wish that was the only time I'd ever heard that, Kathleen.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
So they get points for labeling, but beyond that.
Absolutely. You know, that's a great point, Kathleen. And there's the thing with, I'll just speak specifically to electricity, that is hardest to know are the codes and the things that can and can't be safely done and not safely done. And leaving a live wire inside of a wall to a lot of lay persons can seem absolutely benign. And in the end, it would be so little to make that dangerous. So, yeah, I appreciate your statement for sure.
Yeah, thank you, Kathleen. Appreciate it very, very much. Oh, my gosh. And, you know, just thinking about this, using a professional. Now, this is some years back, the last time I was looking for a house in Madison, there were homes that where there had been remodeling done by the person who owned the home, and I just crossed those out of my list.
Sure.
Because you never know if it's not something that's part of what the home says three bedrooms and there's actually four in there, and it was somebody sort of did some work to do that on the side.
Yeah. Right. We like to look for permits. And the city of Madison has record of any permits that have been pulled for projects and such. And even as a homeowner, we always recommend it. Whatever you're doing, because you can legally work on a ton of different things in your house as an owner-occupant and pull a permit for it. And then you've got the backing of the inspectors that are coming to tell you that it's done right.
Yes.
You can promote that on the sale of the house, electricity specifically. The only thing that the city of Madison, to my understanding, won't allow a homeowner to do themselves is the service upgrade, because there's so many moving parts on it.
Yeah.
But rewiring a room, adding that fourth bedroom that you're talking about, boy, if you pull a permit on that and get all of the right inspections, then you've got that backing for when you go to make that sale.
Yeah.
And inspectors are great in working with homeowners. You know, they're, as they should be, they're a lot less tolerant of professionals not knowing what they're doing.
Right.
But the homeowners, they'll help guide you.
Kathy in Oconomowoc, we'll go to you now. Hi, Kathy.
Well, hi there, Larry. I got a question about a motion detector light outside of the garage. But the wires for the light, for the old light, is coming through the soffit. And most of the lights now that you find in the big box stores have the motion part and the lights like so close together that when the motion light doesn't get activated until you're almost on top of it. And the old light had the motion detector part lower, like on the wall part, and the lights were up higher with two like spotlight bulbs. Do they make those anymore like that, or do they always have to have the motion detector part right up on the light? They don't have it separate anymore.
You know, without looking at it, Kathy, it'd be hard for me to say, but the thing I go to immediately, Rab Manufacturing is a commercial product we use, that their motion sensors have a longer neck on it, so they would tend to protrude down a little bit. I can tell you that most of the big box, if you will, retail places like that, the combined motion sensor units aren't worth the money they're charging anyway, so you're going to want to step outside of that box if you can. Rab Manufacturing does have some product available on Amazon. I'm fairly certain I've seen some of it. I think they have a retail branch part of it. We experience most of them on a commercial basis, but I think there's some of the newer ones where they're putting some retail stuff out there. I would encourage you to check that. WAC Lighting has a motion sensor flood called their Endurance series, which actually I believe has a motion sensor that might dip down a little bit lower, if I'm picturing what you're putting out there. So I would certainly check those two. Not sure if WAC is on retail online. I know they have it at Madison Lighting here in Madison. Oconomowoc, you might be looking into Milwaukee. I believe it was BBC Lighting, something like that, I think is in Milwaukee, might be a place to look. But those are two brands that I would encourage you to kind of check on.
Kathy, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, at 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. Brett in Madison emailed. He's heard that if he installs LED bulbs in a regular traditional light fixture that's on a dimmer switch, that he will need to replace the old dimmer switch with a new one designed for LED bulbs. But he's used the old-timer switch plenty of times with new bulbs, LED bulbs, with no issues.
Depends on the age of the dimmer. So there are quite a few of the old-style dimmers that will work with LED. It depends on the bulb and how old that old, air quotes, dimmer is. They've been making LED dimmers for, 10, 12 years. On a specific, and the LED Lutron Manufacturing as a specific have been making combination dimmers, if you will, things that work with compact fluorescent, dimmable compact fluorescent LED and incandescent, for the last 12 years-ish. But there are, a few LED bulbs, that dimmable LED bulbs that will work with the old one. If the question was posed, is there a safety issue using the old dimmer? Certainly not that I've ever been told.
Yeah. Chad, you agree with that?
Yeah, and we'd find sometimes that there's a compatibility issue that we can't quite explain, but you'll put in a new fixture and you would have thought that the dimmer was going to work, but it doesn't, and so you switch it out and you're fine. So
you switch the dimmer out, probably is
typically.
Easier to switch the dimmer out.
And a lot of that too is you get what you pay for. Right. If it's a good quality dimmer right out of the box, even if it's 15, 20 years old, their manufacturing details may have a better opportunity of working than some of the lesser expensive stuff.
Somebody else had a question about spas or hot tubs. And what do you need to get done first on the electrical side of things before you're, say, putting in a hot tub? Is there a lot to work on, worry about there?
Depends on what the question is referring to. In terms of an electrical service, it goes back to that size. If we've got 100-amp service, air conditioning, electric range, electric dryer, they're going to need to have a service upgrade. Most of the spas that we see are a minimum of 40-amp, 240-volt feeds. There are a ton of code regulations as to where that spa can be placed. Section 680 is a bear. So there's a lot of different things we need to keep in mind on those. In terms of preparation, the service upgrade and power to the spa can be handled as kind of one project, certainly not done in a day. But in terms of pure and simple preparation, you just check the breaker on your main panel. And if it's 100 amp, then you go back and find out how many electric appliances you have. And again, just to call out the specifics, if you've got an electric range, electric dryer, and central air on a 100 amp panel, you're going to need to upgrade before you can put that hot tub in. If you're running all gas appliances on a 100 amp service, you got plenty of power to put in a hot tub.
All right. Makes good sense to me. Design Electric also includes EV charging systems, and you did talk about that a little bit, but how expensive is it in the end to install and then to operate one of those systems?
Boy, I'll be honest, I haven't done the math because the operation part of it is all dependent upon how much power that the car needs. I'd actually be referring a client to MG&E for those calculations for the kilowatt hours and how much of a charge the vehicle needs, how many miles they drove and such. So that's something I've just simply never done the math on. In terms of how expensive is installation, we run all copper. For those feeds, copper's really expensive, so it depends on how far away from the panel is. So that's not a range that I can give with any kind of accuracy. I've done EV chargers for $600-$700. I've done them for $4,000. So it depends on where they're going, the types of obstacles that we have to get past to get there. So that Unfortunately, that's not a canned answer that really is going to help anybody.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's quite a variety of chargers that can be purchased, too. Yeah. Some of them come with a vehicle. Sometimes it's an aftermarket thing.
Yeah. Some of them are coming with a simple cord that plugs into the equivalent of an electric range outlet. So you don't even need the charger on some of them anymore. So there's a lot of components to that answer.
Yeah, and I expect that's going to... A lot of this is going to change. 10 years from now, it's going to look probably a whole lot different, Chad.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, at some point, you know, we'll probably just be driving into our garage and, you know, there will be a magnetic charger that's, you know, we've built into the slab that will be charging the vehicle.
Yeah, I've heard grumblings that they're now replacing battery packs on vehicles instead of charging them at a station. So you just walk in, they pull the pack, put a new one in, and then drive away. So
right.
The technology is so early in the market that it's like talking about LED 15 years ago.
Yeah,
20 years ago.
It made me think right away of my lawnmower and my trimmer and my blower, they're all out of battery, and I can switch the batteries out.
Yeah.
I've got a couple of extra batteries. And
absolutely.
So the same thing for my watch. I put my watch on basically it looks like a magnet.
Yeah, sure. The inductive charge may very well find its way in. It's really hard to say.
John in Mount Horeb has something. Let's go there. Hi, John.
Hi, Larry. I was just wondering if you had any recommendations on a dusk to dawn LED yard light. I bought a couple of them from China off Amazon, and they seem to burn out within a month.
So are you talking about a self-contained fixture with the dusk to dawn in it?
Yeah, usually they have like a little sensor on the top of the yard light, you know, like on a farm.
Yeah, depending on the wattage that you're looking for, again, I always go back into commercial grade. So Rab Manufacturing has some area lights with a dusk to dawn feature that you can add on to it. It's a company out of Milwaukee called Econolite that tends to be a little bit less expensive. They don't have as long of a lifespan as they're bragging about. The Econolite is registered for, say, a 50,000-hour lamp life. Whereas Rab is now talking about 100,000 hours, those two things. I would argue that you get what you pay for in those technologies. The motion sensors and dust-to-dawn sensors have contacts inside of them, and there's a pretty serious inrush on LED when it starts. So if those contacts, the electronics of them aren't as durable, and durable is just money. So the electronics themselves, good ones, cost more money. So, but I would check on Rab Manufacturing and possibly Econolite. Both are things you can search online.
Mm-hmm. John, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Lisa emailed, can you guys explain what smart light bulbs are actually and what they can do and if anything special needs to be done to install them? Smart light bulbs.
Smart light bulbs are, it's exactly what it insinuates. It's a light bulb. You screw it into the fixture, and it takes direction from an app, typically. There's really nothing special. And I'll be first to say I'm not an expert on smart light bulbs because they are a retail-motivated piece. We typically do more what I'll call smart switching, which is kind of a control system that you can integrate throughout the house. But Lisa, specifically on the smart bulbs, no, you take the old bulb out, screw this one in. The thing you want to keep in mind is if it's in a light fixture that's currently on a dimmer, you need to take that dimmer out. Because a dimmer, even at full bright, is already decreasing the voltage. And if you start browning out what they call a brownout, if you start browning out those light bulbs, it will harm the electronics. So before you start putting smart bulbs in, you need to make sure that your dimmers on the wall are gone and just replaced with regular switches. Other than that, if you're putting them into lamps, desk lamps, floor lamps, on a three-way system, again, if you switch them up, they can mess with the electronics if it's not on full bright, the three-way switching on that. So once you get it in, make sure it's on full bright and leave it there. But then it's just taking a little bit of time to program your phone to the bulb.
All right. Makes sense to me. You can join in too, 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. Before we go back to the phones, Kelly had also sent an email. What's the difference between LED or OLED?
Oh, boy. Okay. Not an expert. OLED, I believe, is more of a liquid-based. I think they put it into paints. There was conversation a while back about OLED being a little bit more particulate or something, but I wouldn't scream any kind of expertise on that at all.
Yeah, that's more of a, like, you know, I think of that as being a distinction when I'm going to buy a screen, a television or something, and obviously it is the diodes in that screen, but...
Yeah,
it's not something that we encounter typically in residential lighting.
Dave and Toma has a question. Hi, Dave.
Oh, he was talking about the smart light bulbs. I just wanted to tell him about an interesting bulb I have. It's a old Sylvania, about 20 years old. And if you turn on the light switch, it will turn itself off after about 20 minutes. But if you turn the light switch on twice, it will stay on.
Okay, so it's got a built-in timer. There's a lot of motion sensors that do stuff like that, too. I don't know that I've ever encountered one integrated in the bulb, but that's pretty cool.
I've never seen this before, and I just thought it was interesting. I like having it in closets and things. That way, if I forget, it turns itself off.
Right?
Right.
I had that happen on a light. I was assuming that maybe there was a problem with the bulb or it was heating up too much and then shutting off. Could that be an alternative answer or not?
Well, it certainly could be, you know, depending on the fixture. A lot of times with a recessed light fixture, there is going to, you know, be a built-in control that if that it's overheating, it's going to shut it down. And so...
Yeah, that... The stuff with the LED is typically contained up inside that housing, and while it does, the heat sinks and such do get hot, but to Chad's point on that, that thermal protector is what they call that, shutting down. LEDs don't have as much of an effect on that until it's a failed. But yeah, if they're starting to overheat, typically they're going to shut themselves down. I think that's a technology that's built into quite a few of them.
Yeah. Chad Spade and Travis Larson, our guests today, talking home renovation and repair. And if you've got a home renovation question, I hope you'll join in. The number's 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Tomorrow on Garden Talk, we'll have the author of The Future of Gardens. It's about how climate change and new technologies like AI can change the way you and I grow things. And then we'll get an update from the UW Arboretum about composting. Right now, we're talking home renovation and repair with our two guests, Chad Spade of Chad's Design Build and Travis Larson, president and co-owner of Design Electric of Madison. We've zeroed in on electricity and lighting, but we're certainly more than ready to take other kinds of home renovation and repair questions as well. And you can join us at 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. Kate in Madison, we'll go to you. Thank you for calling.
Dan, Chad, thanks for taking my call. I have a relatively easy question for you, again, on the same vein of electricity and lighting. I bought into recently a condo in Madison, which is the oldest condo in Madison, I'm doing a lot of do-it-myself work. And I have one closet that does not have any lighting in it, and it seems like it'll be a pain to bring electricity into that area. So I'm wondering what's the best options for lighting a closet these days. Is it a rechargeable kind of thing with a USB port or just batteries? Or are there other options that would be feasible without having to wire the light into the closet?
Without having to wire something, you're limited to the battery-powered stuff. I don't know about the rechargeables. And full disclosure, I don't do a ton of recon into battery-powered or rechargeable lights. But with the efficiencies of a lot of the LED, and we get brighter LEDs with lower wattage, it seems like every 6 months. So it wouldn't surprise me if there is a battery-powered type that maybe take AA batteries, and if you wanted to go the rechargeable route, you know, Energizer makes some really good rechargeable AAs that I've used personally, and they seem to last. You want to look at the the milliamp hour ratings on those to get it. But if you can't get wiring there, I think you're kind of stuck with battery operated. And I don't know that I would jump through the USB. It just seems like more work. If you wanted to go rechargeable, I'd get a 4-pack of double A's and see if you can't get a light that takes two of them and keeps cycling
from
them.
There. Yeah. Chad?
Well, and then I would just say, you know, it could be that it ends up being worth the investment to have the wiring run to the closet, but it certainly doesn't hurt to give the rechargeable fixture a try first.
Yeah.
One good thing, Kate, too, is some of the older structures, believe it or not, can be some of the easier ones to work in. A lot of it depends on how they were constructed. We love working on older places because a lot of times they take fewer sharp turns. So, you know, what looks like something that you can't get electricity to, you may find out that there is a little bit more access there than you thought. But again, a lot of it is, you know, based on what was used to construct it. We've been in buildings that it's almost impossible to retrofit, and we've been in buildings that you can get easily accessed wiring without a ton of damage.
Kate, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Let's turn to Tony in Mount Horeb. Tony, hi. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. 1900 house, only in the basement. There's some electrical service that has wires that are covered in a black material, intact black material. The electrician who's been here says it's okay, a true conductor, of course. And where there were outlets in the basement, he put something called an arc fault circuit interrupter instead of ground faults, and that would provide another level of safety. Is that going to be a problem in the future if you try to sell the house, I guess, is my basic question.
You know, a lot of that comes into the person buying the house, Tony. So when you say it's a black coated, but I believe you said two conductor, is that correct?
Yep.
Okay. So the ungrounded Romex is not that uncommon. It's not illegal. It was perfectly code compliant to build, particularly once you get into a house older than the 1940s. I've never seen an arc fault outlet put on a two conductor. It was always my understanding. This could just be because I'm too old to know better, but GFI is always what we had used on a two conductor if we wanted to add the third prong. I'd have to research to find out. You know, until you plug a grounded appliance into it, you know, oftentimes you're not even using the ground as a whole for protection. To your question about the resale, I have seen transactions in a resale application where the potential buyer asks for money back or asks for it to be corrected. I have seen people who understand that a 1900 house comes with some things that they have to fix and they're willing to do it and take it as is. That's going to depend on the buyer, potentially what you're asking for it in terms of the amount of, you know, money and how much of that ungrounded Romex is present throughout the house.
Tony, there you go. Thank you for calling. Myron emailed, and this is, we're turning our attention to decks or sheds for a minute. What, and this is probably for you, Chad, what kind of non-wood building materials do you recommend for decks or sheds?
Yeah, so, well, there are a number of products out there, certainly, that are synthetic. Some of them are wood composite products that have a lot of resin in them that they can be a little bit less plastic-based, mm-hmm. But still have good performance. I am a little hesitant to recommend particular products because we're always kind of revising our opinion mm-hmm. of some of these things that seemed great 5 years ago. You know, we decide maybe not so much. But I will say to name just a few. I mean, certainly Trex is a decking product that we've come to trust in as a brand, and they've had some product failures from back 20 years ago, 25 years ago, but they're on a path now of building a product that we find is very reliable, and that's often a PVC coated product that has a skin on it, but it's not necessarily 100% PVC. And there are a number of composite products out there on the market that can be used on the exterior.
Carly in New Auburn emailed, how often should you flush out your hot water heater? Did you ever flush yours?
Well, so it is definitely something that is recommended, and a lot depends on the need for it is directly related to how regularly you are using hot water in your home. Because if you live in a home where you might go weeks without using hot water, and that would be, say, a second home or something that you're just not around, and maybe months go by and water is sitting in a tank, that is definite, and it's not getting, you know, recirculated or disturbed in any way. I mean, those are situations where you're going to see corrosion happening at an accelerated rate. And so, it is something that is recommended, and I hesitate to say how often because
depends on
it really depends on how you live in the home.
Jason emailed, he noted while shopping for light fixtures, some are made of rattan. Is there a danger of those overheating and starting a fire?
I actually don't know what rattan is, so
it's
I can't answer that.
Like a bamboo or something?
Yeah.
So if it's for sale in a retail space and it has a UL listing on it, or a CTL listing on it, those are put through vigorous tests to be sold as they are. If this is something from a flea market or something that was maybe produced on Etsy or something like that, I would question it simply because wood and electricity can argue. But if it's got a UL listing on the light fixture, not just the pieces that it, because you can see UL listings on the shroud and you can see a UL listing on the socket and the bracket that it mounts to. But unless it's a UL listed assembly, I typically question those. But a lot of it just depends on where you got it.
I guess rattan is Jill's letting me know, rattan's a form of wicker.
Oh,
okay,
like
sure. That makes sense.
I've certainly seen them. So if you're buying it from a reputable retail space, I would absolutely trust it.
And, you know, the other thing there is that often I recall some fixtures that were probably rattan kind of shades around something that just had a bulb socket. And so there, you know, the issue is going to be, well, what type of bulb are you putting in there? And is the shade going to be coming into close contact with that bulb? I mean, obviously, that is when you might be creating a more dangerous situation.
Certainly.
Yeah.
Good question.
Good question indeed. What gauge wire do they run from? This is Scott wants to know, what gauge wire do they run from the panel to the outlet for a level 2 EV charger?
Depends on the ampacity that it's drawn. So level 2 can be set at multiple different ampacities from 30 amp to 60 amp. So when you're drawing the full 60 amp, you have to run a number 6 THHN. So the 663 Romex is only rated for 50 amps. It's a difference in the jacketing on that. So if you're going to pipe it, 6 gauge is what you would run for a 60 amp. If you're setting it on a 50 amp feed, you can run a 63 Romex all the way there. And it kind of shuffles down from there. If you're piping it to a 50 amp, you can run 8 gauge. So it depends on the setting.
And Julie in Sauk City wants to hang some string lights over her concrete patio. Will any old string lights do, or would it be a good idea to get the special waterproof kind?
Special waterproof is going to be important because if it's not, they're going to break. I think in the end, if you have it plugged into a GFI device and that GFI is less than 10 years old and it trips accurately, you know, then it's theoretically going to be safe. But if it's not made to be outside, don't put it there.
Yeah. Okay. Makes sense to me. Chad Spade is owner of Chad's Design Build, and Travis Larson is president and co-owner of Design Electric of Madison. They'll be with us right up until 12:30. We'll take a quick look at the news and find out what else is in store for us here on WPR News, and then we'll be back with Chad and Travis. I'm Larry Mueller. We'll be right back. Great to have you with us here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here talking home renovation and repair with Chad Spate, owner of Chad's Design Build. And with him, Travis Larson, president and co-owner of Design Electric of Madison. Questions for them? I hope you'll join in. Give a call. The number's 800-642-1234. Or you could email to talk@WPR.org. Lots of email questions have come in. Just to take a couple of those right away here. Mark and Wasaki emailed, if you have a coring drill head, is it a good idea to make a DIY radon mitigation system? These can cost a lot of money, and he wants to avoid the cost if possible. Chad, what do you think?
Yeah, so, Mark, it's a great question. And so if the question is it possible to properly install a radon mitigation system with the right tools and then doing it in accordance with best practice? Absolutely. I mean, if you're a talented person and you can core the slab and then connect the parts so that the fan is outside of the envelope. I mean, many people wonder, why do we have to install that fan on the outside of the structure? That, it's ugly and, it seems unnecessary. But the reason for that is that if there ends up being a crack in that housing, then that radon is going to be spilling into the basement. And the little indicator on the pipe that lets you know there's negative pressure in the pipe, which is normally that little red liquid tube that's coming out of the pipe that's showing you that it's pulling in air, it wouldn't matter if it were then leaking back into the house. So that's why the fan needs to be installed on the outside or outside of the envelope. And there are a few other details. I mean, obviously having the wiring done properly. Again, we've discussed on this show that, homeowners can do many things if they're done well. But radon is a serious thing, and in my experience, there are a number of companies that install these systems quite cost-effectively.
Yeah, they're pretty cheap.
But it all comes down to, what are the parts and then whether it's properly installed, so...
Would you pull a permit for something like that?
I would think so, though. It's a $1,500 of the, triggers. Certainly if you're putting in a new circuit for that, you probably should pull a permit. It's always best. I mean, there's an advantage there to the homeowner to have the oversight of the code officials to make sure that you've done it right.
Yeah. Kathy in Milwaukee has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Larry. I'm enjoying your show. Yeah, my question is, I bought some bigger wall hangings from a trip to India, and I'd like to put picture lights on it. Typically, I've used halogen for those in the past, but I'm wondering now with LEDs if that's a better choice for picture lighting. And also, second part of the question is whether or not there are any battery-operated picture lights that would work in place of having to hardwire one in.
So I'll address the easiest one. I got to believe there's battery-powered units, but I've never researched them. There seems to be battery-powered everything now, in terms of just getting flexibility because the LED does use so much or so little power. Truest answer is I have no idea because I've never been forced to research it. In regards to the difference between LED and halogen, again, going back to the fact that the technology is such that it is simulating those colors so well now that I think there's a huge advantage to run an LED on those. If nothing else, the UV protectant nature of it, there was a certain degree of UV light that comes off of halogen. You can get some filters on it, but there is the potential of degradation on some of those pieces with the halogen overextended use. So LED takes a lot of that out of the picture, but I can't imagine where there would be a disadvantage to going with LED on that. And there are quite a few of them. And getting that wired up so that you can put it on with a switch, I feel like that's always a benefit. Being that there are tons of lights that have wireless remote controls, wouldn't surprise me if you find something out there. The thing you want to be careful of is the color rendering. Typically, anything with a battery is going to be a little bit less in terms of the clarity of the color, because I would think that they're going to be a lesser quality. Anyone who's looking for the quality light output is most likely going to be looking towards something that gets wired in. That would be the only thing to pay attention to. The color rendering index is something that you want to watch for. And in its basic terms, the higher the CRI, color rendering index, the better clarity that you're going to see out of that light. So you want to be sticking over a 90 CRI anytime you can.
All right. Kathy, there you go. Thank you for calling. Lee in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Lee.
Yeah, this question is in regards to siding, especially like the cement type siding. I think they call it hardy board.
Yeah.
Didn't they have problems in the past with it cracking or some shattering or I don't know. Installation is a little harder. You know, have they improved? Is it worth going through the, I'm sure they're higher priced.
Well, so that's a great question. I mean, one of the disadvantages to cement siding is that it will bend pretty easily. If you hold a siding board flat in your hands and let it, you know, extend out, you know, 6 feet in both directions, a hardy plank board can actually snap. So you have to handle it very carefully so that that doesn't happen. And that's one of the downsides to working with that material. It's also very heavy because it is a cement-based product. And so it is both kind of difficult to work with and heavier. But that said, I mean, there are instances where that might be the best product for what it is you're looking to do. And so it would have to be properly installed and carefully handled. There are many things that get installed on homes that need to be handled with care. You know, we're talking a lot about lighting today, and, you know, you can't be rough with most light fixtures when you're installing them. So, there are other products on the market. We're big fans at our company of Smart Siding for a good value. That is not a cement-based product. That is a wood chip-based product that's got epoxies in it. And it has similar positive attributes to the hardy plank as far as its durability and resistance to pest and to the elements. But like anything else, it also has its negative attributes. And so, you know, good old-fashioned wood siding or masonry siding, if properly maintained, are hard to beat. But there is maintenance involved there. So
yeah, that's to consider. And on those other ones, John Freiberger usually says, go to the manufacturers, get their directions for installation, make two copies. Give one to the installer.
Right.
And keep one for yourself.
Absolutely. Like anything else, something that's not properly installed probably isn't going to perform. So,
Lee, there you go. Thank you. Brad in Door County, your turn. Hi, Brad.
Hey, Larry. So I was calling about the caller who called in about the mitigation system, and I just wanted to let him and others know that there is alternative methods for sealing radon out of cement or cementitious-based products, and it's a spray-applied products that are radon certified, less than one perm, so it meets all of the codes for doing that. The caveat, obviously, is it can't be a finished basement. It has to be exposed, and it can work for walls, floors, etc. Much like Travis had mentioned several times throughout today's show, is that it's going to be on the commercial side that is where you pick material up, but it can be used in the residential construction.
I'm not sure exactly what the caller is referring to. I mean, first off, you know, we're talking about radon. You know, radon is a naturally occurring soil gas that you either have it under mm-hmm. a building or you don't. There's no way to know without testing, but it is very common in South Central Wisconsin. And it is a serious health threat if it's coming into a living space. But there are absolutely ways to seal up cement to potentially prevent it from coming in. And it's just the issue is that if you have it, often it's hard to get at all of those surfaces in, say, a partially used basement to effectively prevent it from coming into the space if it's been detected. But it is something, even when you have a radon mitigation system, you're going to want to test from time to time to make sure that you still don't have radon coming into your home. So there are a lot of variables here. And again, if you're not testing for radon, you have no way of knowing that it's in your air.
Yeah. Brad, thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. As I was thinking about that, I was thinking about all the stuff I've got in my basement that I'd have to move out of the basement in order to put the, to put the material down. But if it's, you know, if done right, I guess it'll work. If you were looking at my basement, you'd say, oh, no.
You're going to put the radon mitigation system, huh?
Maggie emailed. She's trying to spiff up her aging bathroom. A nice clean bead of caulk around the bathtub edge would look nice, but Maggie's attempts at caulking are bad, not smooth, nor precise. I'm just wondering, any tips, I guess, is what she's looking for.
Sure. Well, so a couple of things. I mean, caulking can be a bit of an art, it does take some patience, and you probably have some failed caulk jobs that you'll be tearing off and cleaning up and reapplying as you're getting the hang of it. But some important tips is you want to properly clean the surface before you're installing the caulk. So that means, of course, removing all the old caulk. You're typically going to use some sort of fairly mild solvent to just clean off the surface. And then you're going to be applying that. A lot of times when you're not doing it all the time, I might recommend masking off both sides, both surfaces, that so that when you tool the caulk, which you can do either with a finger or with some tools that you might buy at the hardware store, so to make that final bead look nice, you then remove the masking tape on both sides so that you've got a nice clean line. You haven't smeared caulk 1 inch up one side of your tub or the tile, and then that might, those basic tips right there, I think, might allow you to, proper cleaning, having masked it off, and then, tool it and remove the masking. I think if you follow those steps, you can end up with a pretty decent result.
I should have talked to you 15 years ago when I was trying that myself. You know what I did? I did not start on the product, on the area itself. I first practiced.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, that's a good. Yeah.
I first practiced a little bit that I got it to work, but I wish I'd done that tape. That tape idea was a very good one. Very good one indeed. Well, here's Casper in Sparta with a shower with really low water pressure. What could cause this? They've switched out shower heads. Nothing seems to work.
Yeah, so the likely culprit is that there is some debris in the water pipe on the supply side of the valve itself. And so there's a cartridge typically in the valve if it's a single handle a shower valve, where the hot and cold come together in the valve, and that cleaning out that or replacing that cartridge might fix the problem. Sometimes you've got to drain the system to try to get that whatever has gotten into the system that might be restricting flow. But we often find when there's been a big renovation, it's not unusual that some sort of debris has gotten into a water line, and it will you know, gunk things up wherever it finds resistance and lodges itself. And so this is not an entirely uncommon thing to have to troubleshoot.
Randy emailed, he was looking at a heated roof system with climate change slowing down, ice dam and snow buildup problems. Do you recommend a heated roof system?
So, I mean, Travis can speak to what those systems end up looking like because they are electric, typically electric wire systems. And what we just say from the bigger picture best practice for maintaining your home is that if you have ice dams, you definitely want to address that so that your house isn't getting damaged by them. And the best solutions have to do with air sealing and insulating and then ventilating properly, but sometimes that's hard to do, and sometimes it could just be the way the house is built that there's a space that isn't really ever getting sunlight, and the wind likes to blow the snow there, and you have massive piles of snow, and it's not easy to clean it off safely. Because another thing that you might be able to do, if you can safely remove snow after a heavy snow, that's a great way to reduce the need for any of these other solutions. But if all of that fails, or it just is, you know, it's not convenient to get up there, putting in some sort of a wire to melt that snow can be an effective solution.
Yeah, the thing with ice melt and heat tape and all of that makes it something that we really don't ever recommend necessarily until all of the other more proper fixes are. Insulation, air sealing, and ventilating the attic space is really the way you try to get rid of that in its prime. But when we have to put them on there, the thing you want to keep in mind with that, especially if it's kind of a Band-Aid because it's a finite lifespan. They're not going to last forever. These things take a ton of abuse. When they're not running in the middle of summer, they're taking a ton of UV. So, you know, sure, the jacketing is going to potentially crack. We don't, some of them can last up to 20 years, but boy, I don't know that I've seen it. They'll use anywhere from 5 watts to 7 watts a foot. And you've got to put, you know, depending on the size of the roof line, you've got to do a V-shaped up and down. You've got to run it through the gutters, down through the downspouts, because once you get it off of the roof, if you don't keep it warm enough to get down and out of the gutters and downspouts, you just change where the ice buildup is. So it can be problematic, and it can be a great fix when you have to. All of Chad's suggestions should absolutely be first.
All right. Dylan wants to sell his house. Which would increase the resale value more, a kitchen or bathroom remodel?
Well, I would say, you know, how badly do either of those rooms need to be renovated? I would say, as a general rule, remodeling a home for resale I would focus on things that are necessary maintenance and not necessarily aesthetic improvements, because the new homeowner would probably rather have that money to do it their way.
I can remember the house that I own now. The owner of the house was going through it with me and remarked that all the time and effort he'd put into the new bathroom that he had put in, which I didn't tell him, but I knew the minute that I took ownership, the bathroom was going.
Right, right.
And the other quick story was the friend who had a lake home and had time, so spent about a year just on his own redoing his kitchen, sold the house, and then came back a couple of weeks later just to see the house, and it was flat. The whole house was gone, and a new house was coming up.
The lesson is you can't guess what the next owner's going to like or dislike.
But yeah. I really do like your idea about, you know, fixing those little things that, that you know, make the house
Yeah, and if you have a dripping faucet, for example, and it's beyond the point of being able to repair it, then, you know, maybe you switch out that faucet. And same with a toilet that's not operating properly. These are things that I think of more as maintenance things, you know, like a roof that needs to be replaced. Whenever a home has been well maintained, and that just might be because it looks great when you're there considering buying it, but that, you know, neglect of things that lead to long-term damage are warning signs. But a poorly designed kitchen or old tired cabinets and countertops, I mean, these are things that can be fixed as well, but the cost of replacing them is pretty significant.
Yeah.
And then doing it cheaply, I mean, is that really attractive to someone? You know, I'm not sure.
I would agree. And I've had some experiences along those lines. That poor guy just bragged about that bathroom, and I thought, oh, I'm sorry, but it's going. The minute you're out of the house.
Right.
On that note, Chad, Travis, has been a lot of fun.
Thank you both very much for
being with us today. We'll look forward to your next visit. Travis Larson is president and co-owner of Design Electric of Madison, and Chad Spade is owner of Chad's Design Build. And just by way of full disclosure, I should mention that Chad's Design Build is one of Wisconsin Public Radio's many business sponsors, and certainly thank them for that as well. Coming up next, we're going to take a look at water and mold issues in the home. And so that's next. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. When unwelcome water sneaks into your house, it's not only inconvenient, it can cause serious health issues if it's left unchecked. Larry Mueller, turning our attention to mold and water damage repair on the show now with our guest, Joseph Minorek. Joe is Director of Operations at Minorek Mitigation. They have a certification from the Institute of Inspection Cleaning and restoration certification. Minorek Mitigation is based out of Mount Pleasant, serves the Milwaukee area. So as we talk with Joe, I hope you'll join in. Tell us where you've uncovered mold in your home, or what do you need to know about the type of mold you found, or let us know how you keep the water out of your basement. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Joe Minorek, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you for having us. I appreciate it, especially the small business.
Yeah, well, I tell you what, it's good. I know you know a lot, and I have a lot of questions for you, and our listeners probably do as well. When people reach out to your company, what sort of problems or products do they need help with?
Oh, we get plenty of questions about water damage in the basement, somewhere in the house along the lines of refrigerators, dishwashers, plenty of mold. Mostly in the attic spaces, that's a big concern. Fire jobs, we get those quite frequently as well. Someone cooking, not paying attention, catching fire real quick.
Gotcha. And maybe give us a story behind why you decided to start Minorek Mitigation.
Well, after working for a couple other companies, I figured it was something that I really enjoyed doing. I like having the aspect of having a change of scenery every single day. And, I just came to that point where I decided that, I'm going to take the opportunity to do this for myself, put my name on something and see where we can go with this.
Yeah, well, makes good sense. Let's talk about mold for a bit here. What are the most common fungal issues you see in homes?
Like I said, up in the attic space, we get a lot of calls about that. Closets in the cantilever closets. There's, you know, it's great for conditions in California, but when we have the weather changes in Wisconsin, it's not so great.
Yeah. We get a lot of questions on the show about what everybody calls black mold. How can you tell if you have this type of mold, and is it serious?
So there are plenty of different types of molds that are black. Unfortunately, I cannot be the one to tell you especially which mold you have. That has to be done by a microbiologist or an industrial hygienist. The company that we work for is fantastic. They usually get out there pretty quick. They identify exactly what we're dealing with, and we basically go by their recommendations of what needs to be done to properly contain the area, to take care of the issue, and to give them a healthy indoor air quality.
Yeah. And health effects. There can be, a variety of health effects if you have mold.
That is correct.
What are some of the worst ones?
We come across a lot of, breathing issues, allergies, things of that nature. I've heard of people having, severe headaches when they're in their home, but when they go in, on vacation, stay in a hotel, all their symptoms are completely gone.
Yeah. Well, you want to get that taken care of for sure. Jeff and Barry Mills has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Jeff. Thank you for calling.
Yes, good morning. I guess this is pretty timely. I just had a fire in my mobile home this weekend. And there's a lot of wet insulation and everything hanging around. I'm sure the floor is going to... I had a question about mostly the ozone machine. Is that pretty effective for getting the stuff out of the house?
the smells and the all the materials? Ozone machines, Joe.
So there's a lot of different techniques that are put into getting odors out of smoke jobs and fire jobs. Ozone machine is one of them. A hydroxyl machine is a little bit more friendly with the resident. It doesn't, I forgot how to explain it. But the hydroxyl is a safer route to go over the ozone machine. There's other options like thermal fogging. Obviously, you want to get rid of all the burnt up materials, and then sealing. That's another aspect of odor control.
Yeah, sealing off the affected area so that it doesn't happen. Jeff, does that help out?
Yeah, somewhat. And I guess, it's a good thing the weather's nice, so we can just pull the skirting off and air out the underneath and get rid of the wet stuff. But yeah, it helps.
Yeah, okay. Jeff, thank you very much for calling. You can join in too at 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. The thing about mold, and I had a situation in my home one time a few years back where I actually have a water system for fire in my home, and one of the beads broke and on the pipe, and the water ran down the inside of the walls. I called the insurance company, and they said, well, they recommended somebody from the Madison area and said, get them over right away, because things need to be taken care of right away or very quickly, Joe, if a situation like that develops.
That is correct. You got 24 to 72 hours before mold growth can actually start after a water loss of any sort.
Yeah. So, let's talk about what you do if you discover a problem. What's the first thing?
So we go over to our customer's house, obviously do our inspection, give them our recommendations, whether it's talking to a microbiologist or, just going straight into the estimate portion of the work. For mold, we do a lot of physical removal. We explain that, how we do that. We try staying away from as much chemical products as possible because everything's, you know, everyone's trying to go green nowadays and stay healthier. The best route to go about getting rid of mold is physical removal. You know, there's a lot of different types of molds that our microbiologist has indicated can be cleaned with something as simple as Dawn dish soap and physical abrasion.
And others take what?
Others, you know, you do have to rely on some of those harsher chemicals. So that at that time, we kind of recommend that customer finds a place to stay overnight or whatever it may be for however long it may take for that job to be completed.
Yeah. Mary Kay in Kenosha. We'll go to you now. Hi, Mary Kay.
Hi. I have a question about black mold and the law. I live in an apartment complex. There's 14 buildings, and it was built in the 70s, and there's an entire room that it has an opening in it, okay? When they open it up, I think to fix a pipe or something, the whole room has got black mold on it. I'd like to know what the law is for tenants to make these people fix things.
Hmm.
Unfortunately, I cannot give any of that type of information out. That would be something you'd have to contact a lawyer about.
Yeah, I would think that Kenosha probably, I would think maybe their home inspection unit. Kenosha has to have home inspectors that are paid for by the city. And you might want to check with them because you could probably pretty quickly get some information from them about what your options are. Because if you've got a room that's completely covered with kind of a blackish mold, I would think they would have to be fixing that. Whoever owns the apartment complex. Certainly makes sense to me anyway. Somebody else is wondering, is mold a bigger problem in older homes in your experience?
In my experience, I see mold in brand new constructions, older homes. It all depends on the quality of the build. You know, I know Chad touched bases on airflow through attic space. That's probably the biggest factor that we come across in attics, you know, the improper airflow.
So that's that, and that makes the most sense to me too. If it's not properly taken care of, and you get it in the attic, and then it's going to wind up getting somehow spread through the other parts of the house, won't it?
Yeah, whether it's through the duct system, you know, you turn your AC or your furnace on, you're going to cross contaminate some areas, especially if your furnace is located in the attic space.
Yeah. And what are the best methods to stop mold from growing then? We're looking at the attic area, but what about other parts of the house?
You want to make sure that your appliances aren't leaking, you know, faucets, things of that nature. Make sure that you're keeping your relative humidity in your house, you know, as close to 35% as possible. Obviously, it's not as easy as everyone would assume, but that's the ideal percentage range to be at for indoor mold growth not to occur.
And dehumidifiers, what's the best time of the year to run a dehumidifier, let's say, in the basement?
Summertime, springtime, fall, or winter. You know, we got high moisture in Wisconsin.
So in other words, whatever season of the year, you could, if you're going to run a dehumidifier in the basement, you run it then.
just make sure you're emptying the bucket if it's not a drain line system.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure. Joe Minorik, our guest today. He is Director of Operations at Minorik Mitigation. They're based out of Mount Pleasant, Wisconsin, and serve the Milwaukee area. Great talking with him. If you have questions about water issues and mold, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us. The email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look today at water and mold issues in the home with our guest, Joseph Minorek. Joe is Director of Operations at Minorek Mitigation. Out of Mount Pleasant, served the Milwaukee area. It's great to have him with us. Just a quick mention, tomorrow on Garden Talk, we'll have the author of The Future of Gardens. It's about how climate change and new technologies like AI change the way we can grow things. And then we'll get an update from the UW Arboretum and talk about composting. But right now, we're talking water and mold issues with Joe. Great to have him along. And let's talk about water. I know, Joe, you deal with water damage remediation at your business. How does water generally, how does it get in the house in the first place?
Well, we got multiple different ways. We have, you know, the supply lines. We have drains. We have sump pumps. Houses that don't have any sump pumps whatsoever. Gutters, the downspouts is a big issue. A lot of people call us about foundation issues, you know, discoloration in their basement, moisture issues. And a lot of times we go out there and their foundation is fine. It's more or less the grading and the downspouts that are causing the issues that they do see. Obviously, heavy rains, power outages, those are things to bring in the water.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you, let's say you find some standing, you got some standing water in your home, it's probably going to be in the basement, would be my guess, if you're going to find it after the fact quite a bit. What's the first step you should take?
Well, I would definitely take some pictures. That way, if you're going through insurance, you have documentation already started. Definitely pick up the phone and call a professional. A lot of people do not do that. They try taking care of the issue themselves, and unfortunately, it leads to the secondary damages such as mold. You definitely want to get that area dry. You don't necessarily want to use air movers just in case there is some microbial growth taking place. Get all the water out by sucking it out with a vacuum by any means that you can, and then having a dehumidifier set up until you can identify all the damaged materials.
Yeah, so quite a few steps there. And how do you determine if this damage warrants removing drywall or flooring or other building materials?
All depends on the category of water. You know, a Category 1 loss is usually clean water. That's something that a lot of times, as long as there's no insulation present in those building materials, it can be dried in place with the specialty equipment that we have. Category 2 is gray water. That's something that, you know, depending on how long it's sat, you may want to start, you know, removing some drywall here and there. And then you got your Category 3, which is black water, you know, sewage backup, things of that nature. You want to make sure you're getting all the materials that you possibly can out, and then power washing whatever you can't and, you know, treating it that way.
Yeah, that makes sense. The smell, what's the best way to remove the musty smell?
The musty smell is usually because it wasn't handled correctly. As long as you're removing all the materials that did get wet and drying the area properly, you shouldn't have that smell lingering.
Yeah, I was I would have had the Category 1 water, I think, in my home when I had that issue. The water was coming down the inside of the walls because, of course, the sprinkler system wasn't set on the edges. It was set, you know, kind of in the middle of the house. And so we had sort of a blower system, I think, the guys were using. They came over right away and started on it. What kind of a system do you use when you've got something like that?
So we utilize dehumidifiers, air movers, air scrubbers, inject-to-dry systems. The inject-to-dry system is two-way usable. It's got some hoses that we can drill holes into the walls and pump air through there. And then it has a floor mat system where it's directed towards hardwood flooring and LVP flooring, where it actually sucks the moisture up through there.
So it takes it in one hose and pulls it out and throws it out the other one.
Depends on how it's set up. Yep.
Oh, man. A question about from somebody about a leaky toilet or shower. If you've got a bulge in the ceiling, I don't know. Is it a good idea to cut into the bulge to remove the water that's built up?
I would definitely make sure that you are putting some sort of plastic down to protect whatever floor that is going to be landing on or whatever surfaces that may be. You know, you might want to consult a professional before you go ahead and do that, whether that's a plumber, you know, to figure out exactly what the issue is that's causing it, or, you know, a specialist like myself.
And back again to the outside of the house, you were talking about the downspouts and the outspouts and the grading. What are the, and I've talked about this on the show in the past, and I've forgotten the exact measurements for it, but what are we talking about in terms of sloping away from the house? I mean, to prevent water from going in, and length of downspouts.
From my understanding, the length of downspouts is ideal to be about 12 to 15 feet directed away from the foundation of your home. As far as the grading goes, I'm not 100% certain on that. That's not one of my expertise. We do work with a contractor that is his expertise. But I do know that, you know, you definitely don't want the ground sloping towards your foundation. You want to be able to see a noticeable difference. That way water is traveling away from it.
Jan emailed, how do people know if there's mold in the basement? Is it smell, or is there something more scientific as a way to tell?
Well, that's a good question. Mold in the basement can be invisible, you know, such as if you got paneling on your walls, you may not ever see anything going on. But because your foundation wall may get condensation, you may actually have some growth going on the backside of that. Sometimes you'll smell it, sometimes you won't. It all depends on the type of mold that you're dealing with as well. You know, something like a surface growth may not have any lingering odor. Something more like the quote-unquote black mold, the toxic black mold, Stachybotrys, that's something that you probably will smell.
Yeah. I would think so. Fortunately, the house I'm in now, I haven't had that. I haven't had to worry about that. If you got a story, you know, without talking about who the people are or anything, tell us some of your recent experiences working with homes.
Well, we went down to Texas with all those burst pipes. We went out to New Jersey for some hurricane relief. Obviously, we met some fantastic people along the way. One gentleman had a train set in his basement that he spent a lot of time on. This gentleman was about 80-some years old, and that was his retirement gift for himself. Build his most fantastic train set that he possibly could. Unfortunately, they lived really close to the river that ended up destroying the whole basement and the 4 feet up on his first floor. You know, obviously dealing with the heartache, it was kind of touching to us that we were able to help him. His project took about a week and a half just for all the material removal to be done, and then another 5 days for it to actually dry out thoroughly. From my understanding, before they actually got back into their house, it was about a year and a half's worth of time because of how much work needed to be done at his property. That was one of my, I guess, most heartbreaking situations that I've had to go through as a contractor in this industry. Then we got some mold jobs. You know, there's a lot of people that think that just because they're seeing some sort of discoloration, that it's a life or death situation, when that's not always the case. Like I mentioned, the surface growth behind paneling, that's not necessarily anything that's toxic, but it's also not good to have in your home. But it's there's a lot worse molds out there, like the Stachybotrys, that, yes, indeed, that is something that you want to address as soon as possible. then we've got some fire jobs. We've made some great contacts with the fire jobs just because there's so many different trades that are involved in those. You know, if you got even the simplest smoke-filled kitchen, that's going to go into your duct work. So your recommendation is to have your ducts cleaned after we're done with our portion of the work. You know, electrical fires, we've came across some great electricians.
So a lot of different kind of jobs there, really.
Oh, yeah. Yep. On average, we're seeing probably about 30 to 40 jobs per month, roughly. Not saying that we're getting all of them, but just being able to go and look at them is definitely something.
Yeah, I would think so. Steve emailed, how well do furnace filters help with preventing mold? Is it worth the extra dollars to upgrade to the most expensive filter?
I can't necessarily say for a fact that, yes, go ahead and spend more money on the better filter. That could be an advertising thing. Some of the HVAC companies that we work with do make different products for, you know, sicknesses, illnesses, mold-related cleaning, I guess you could say. From my understanding, it's like a ozone ionizer system that can be put onto the furnace. That has been used in conjunction with, you know, cheaper filters to kind of save the money there. But, you know, I don't have the science behind it saying that, yes, indeed, it is better to go with a better filter. I personally do run the higher MERV count in our furnace.
And the MERV count, what would be a high MERV count?
I believe ours is a 10, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, 10, okay. And we had an email from Buck. His wife's been complaining about extra itchiness lately. And she says it's either mold or the chemicals left by the lawn service.
And that is a very good possibility. Mold does have that effect on some people. It could be more extreme for one other person than it is for another. It's all up to their immune system. The microbiologist that we work with, there's someone that could come out and give you a definite answer on if you do have an issue and what that issue may be. I know some pesticides, they have that type of effect on people as well.
Yeah. And one more from Bob. How important is it to clean the vent in your clothes dryer to help prevent moisture in the house?
As far as that goes, I'm not 100% certain on the moisture aspect of the house. It definitely will create some extra humidity that you definitely don't want. I would be more concerned about a clogged tube starting a fire, if anything.
Yeah, I had some birds build a nest in the pipe, one of the pipes, even though I had a cover on it. They figured out one of those louvered covers they have, that was too easy for them. They quickly figured out how to lift that lever and get in there, and it was the tube was half full of nest material, and it's not something you want to have if you want to avoid having a fire. Well, Joe, how long have you been in business now?
We have been in business since October of 2019.
Okay, and so business sounds like business is pretty good.
It's moving. It's definitely not failing at this point in time. I would say we could definitely do better, but obviously being a small business, we don't have the gigantic funds that, you know, the franchise companies have to advertise and whatnot.
Well, Joe, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you for taking time to be with us, and appreciate your comments very much. Joseph Minorek, Director of Operations at Minorek Mitigation. They're based out of Mount Pleasant, and they serve the Milwaukee area. And thank you so much for joining us today. It's a team effort, as always. Our producers, Clara Neipert and Joel Patnod, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, our technical directors, and our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks again for listening in, and stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.